Hey everyone, I just wanted to say really quick, I have a new podcast that you can listen to if you want to. It's called The Level Up Pod, together with Murph, who some of you may know from Game Nights or the Command Zone podcast. We're just talking about the video games we own, the consoles we love, and why we love collecting. You can check it out anywhere where podcasts are found. Follow us at LevelUpPod_ on Twitter. Thanks. Hello and welcome to the Herald's Horn, episode 19. On this episode, Emma and I are tackling the hard issues like where are metas settling after all of those bans? What? Magic the Gathering TV show was just canceled. And that's it, really. We're also going to talk about Duskmourn a whole of a lot. After the break, I am joined by the one and only Elliot Raff, longtime MTG judge and now competitive Magic player. And by now, I mean, he's been one for a while. We have a great chat about the state of Magic the Gathering judges. What is it that judges need? Is Wizards giving them anything? No. But what could help repair the situation? Without further ado, let's get into the episode. And of course, when I say without further ado, I really quick just want to talk to you about this show. I've been doing this for 9 months. This is episode 19. That's kind of crazy to me. I can't believe it. You know, we're a bi-weekly show, and I personally would really like to take the show weekly. Crazy, right? The problem is, I don't have the time, nor really the motivation specifically to edit 4 or 5 episodes of The Herald's Horn a month. To be frank, I'm bad at it too. So I would love to be able to pay someone else to edit the show for me, enabling me to take it weekly, and also to free up more of my time to focus on stuff like interviewing people. If you enjoy the show, if you would like to hear more from the show, if you would like more episodes of The Herald's Horn, then the best thing you can do is quite literally support us on Patreon. I'm not sure exactly what that number needs to be for us to go weekly, for me to be able to pay someone else or a multitude of people to edit an episode of the show every single week. But hey, when I know, I'll let you know. Hey, and if you support the Patreon, I'll even send you a sticker in the mail. How about that? Thanks so much for listening. Let's get into the episode. Hello, it's time for the Herald's Horn. My name is Cal Jones, now no longer with an eyebrow piercing. And today I am joined by the wonderful Emma. Emma comes to us all the way from the future. What's up, Emma?
Hey, how's it going?
Oh, it's going. I didn't say hi, Emma. That's on me.
Okay. I messed up. Hello, Cal.
Hello. You know what? Without any further ado, let's get into the episode. All right, and we are back. We're going to hop right into the news. Not much news on this episode. Not a whole lot going down in the Magic the Gathering community, the larger Magic the Gathering community. Over the last couple of weeks, at least that's not on the spectrum of news that we usually don't really talk about. So let's talk about where competitive metagames have kind of ended up after the last big round of bans. Pioneer moving all over the place after the banning of both Amalia and Sorin. From what I understand, it's pretty much a wasteland over there. And we haven't had an uncharted land over in Pioneer, and people are starting to figure out decks, but it's all weird. All the data we have for Magic the Gathering online it's like what we have right now to go off of largely. And people are too bored with Phoenix to play it in Mitgo leagues, really. So we don't actually know how decks are performing against Phoenix, because nobody really says, hey, let me get that Phoenix League in. No one's doing that right now. So I guess we'll have to see on Pioneer. Emma, you Pioneer gamer?
Not massively. I did sell out of my Pioneer deck just because my store doesn't fire it. So so I had Boris Convoke because I get to play Fragrant Inspector. But I sold the deck because I don't really... The store doesn't play Pioneer, so it's just like, what's the point keeping this? But no, Pioneer's in an interesting spot because of those bans. And what we're seeing in Pioneer is that a lot of sacrifice strategies are coming back to the front, because Vayne Ripper was notoriously good against sacrifice decks. So with Sorin out of the format, that's kind of soft returned these sacrifice decks. And with Ygritte, Eater of All, who's very, very good in these style decks. So now you're seeing like a lot of creature focused decks come back to the fold because Amalia's gone. So there isn't this board wipe that's baked into a creature as well. So you've got Mono White Humans, which was a deck that was around for a minute. Then you've got Mono Green Devotion coming back. And then you've got like these sacrifice decks. And then you've got these like different flavors of Rakdos Midrange trying to figure out what they're doing post, you know, Sorin ban. So yes, it's interesting. However, it is not the RCQ format right now. So
it's not the RCQ format. No one is super incentivized to figure out the best of the best creatures. So we're just kind of like, here.
Also, Standard seems great.
Yeah, Standard seems great. Standard seems to be having a great time. I need to like look into whether or not my store fires Standard, or I'm sure a store in Columbus. There's several pretty good ones. I'm sure a store in Columbus, Ohio fires Standard, because I want to play Gruul Prowess. That deck looks sick.
Deck seems sweet. It might be, is it Prowess soon? Because there's a slip-free space in Duskmourn, basically. Oh,
okay. Yeah, that makes sense. It might be hard to get away from Questing Druid. I don't know. Questing Druid seems pretty sick. But yeah, I mean, that's one of the very few green cards actually in the deck, like Questing Druid. And then you get to like play, pick your poison in the sideboard or whatever, which I'm sure is quite good. Also, of course, Snakeskin Veil, +1/+1 counter, hexproof. Not that bad either. Yeah, Standard's shaping up. Pioneer is shaping up. Banning Grief along with Nadu in Modern. I've seen the perception on that one swing a little bit already. A lot of when it was banned, a lot of people online were like, okay, it's like annoying, but it's not like oppressively good, right? Well, a lot of people have already been pretty happy that it's gone, because it does kind of look like... there's so many, you know, like Dimir Murktide is so good. Mardu Energy is like still so good. Some other black decks are still good enough that people are like, oh yeah, if these decks had Grief, that may have been too much. But in Grief's absence, something is certainly filling up the voids in everyone's heart, Emma. What is that?
Is it the One Ring that somehow is still around in Modern?
Yeah, it's the One Ring. It is officially the most played card in the format, even more than any one land as of yesterday. Which is, yeah, it's pretty intense. Like historically, you know, the most played land in Modern is like Scalding Tarn or Misty Rainforest or whatever, depending on the flavor of the week. But as of right now, it is the One Ring, and that makes sense. It's 4 mana is a little bit much, right? But it's 4 mana that makes it so your opponent cannot do anything to you until your next turn, and then you just get to draw cards. And since you get to play 4 of them, oh, bird encounters getting a little bit high. Yeah, I'll cast another one. Cool.
The only downside to the One Ring is that it currently costs $120 for a copy.
Holy moly. I sold mine too soon.
For same as it ever copies. Was. Just a quick look at TCG Player. $120. So a place that's going to set you back, what, $480?
Yep.
Which is insane.
Yeah, that is a huge barrier to entry. Looking at MTG Goldfish right now, like even Boros Energy, a deck that pretty much plays 1-drops, 2-drops, and also Flage, is just like, it's so good at reloading even Boros Energy has recently started playing it. So if you do want to play the current top version of Boros Energy that's on MTG Goldfish, It will cost you, let's see, I'm running the numbers. It would cost you $700. Or if you wanted to play the One Ring, it'll cost you $12. How's that sound?
Welcome to modern, folks.
Into a $1,200 modern deck again? What year is it? No, modern decks are always a little bit pricey. I try not to think about that too much. So yeah, the Nadu is gone. So there doesn't seem to be like a massive power outlying deck. It seems instead we have kind of end up in there's a wide variety of decks that people are playing, and there seems to be a wide variety of decks that are viable. It just seems that almost all of those decks happen to want to play four of the One Ring, which is it feels like a position that we haven't really been in a long time, you know, like, and none of these decks really have to make sacrifices to play this card, because it is colorless. They just have to be able to make four mana on turn four. I think that's a lot of the, like, you want to cast it on curve, I'm sure, but I don't.
Well, the thing is, so you either play the One Ring or you play cards that counteract the One Ring. So you have Dimir Murktide, which runs Psychic Prog, which is another very good card from Modern Horizons 3, which runs four Consigned to Memory in the sideboard, which is this uncommon from MH3 that does a really good job of tackling Eldrazi decks and the One Ring. That's like $8 a copy right now, because it just is so good at just counteracting the One Ring decks that are just everywhere now.
Consigned to Memory, such a fun card. It costs a blue. It has Replicate 1, so you can copy it for each time you paid its Replicate cost. And then it says counter target triggered ability or colorless spell. So yeah, just play your Consigned to Memory, pay 2 mana, counter both the One Ring and it's wait, no, is the protection trigger on the enter of the battlefield?
It's when you cast it from your hand.
Oh my gosh. Gross. Okay.
Also, another cute thing you could do, you can counter, so if you're playing Jeskai Control, you can consign the Flay's trigger when you pay 3 mana for it, so gross. It doesn't sacrifice.
That's cute.
It's also really cool.
That's fun. Look, I'm just happy that we are in a modern where people can put Chained to the Rocks into their sideboard again. I'm seeing that. Yeah. I'm seeing that in multiple decks. I'm seeing two of Chained to the Rocks again. Modern is healing. We are going right back to 2017. 2017 is a little late even for Chained to the Rocks being played that
much. I think it was more like 2016.
More like 2016. Whenever, you know, Boros Energy was something people were, not Boros Energy, Boros Burn was something people really wanted to do. Well, okay. The modern is settling in. Maybe the One Ring is a little too good. I'm sure that'll be addressed sometime, maybe. But in the realm of things that'll maybe be addressed sometime, Psychic Frog. You mentioned Psychic Frog. Great new cards from Modern Horizons 3, Emma. They did not ban it out of Legacy. They banned Grief in Legacy, and they said and hoped that, you know, that would take the Riskaminator decks down that were kind of dominating the format. And Riskaminator, as it currently existed, is not really a deck anymore, but what is a deck is really solid blue-black decks that happen to be able to play a great evasive card in Psychic Frog. And then also normal, like, Reanimator decks are kind of just going back to their normal form. Like, not you know, definitely a different game plan if you can't plan on reanimating a Grief on turn one, right? So that's returning to a little more normal, but Psychic Frog containing decks, at least through the first like week and a half, 2 weeks of the format with the data we have available, it seems that Psychic Frog is a little tough. And on the last episode, when we were talking about the bans and the new schedule, they have 4 bans, which is centered more around RCs and RCQ seasons, you know, so rather than always having the ban announcement right when a set releases and then they talk themselves into saying, well, we don't know how this new set is going to affect any of the formats, so we'll just wait. Now, hopefully they'll be able to say, oh, Modern season is here. We know this Modern card is problematic. Let's ban this card in Modern before the season starts. A byproduct of this, I think, very logical change is that there is now going to be longer amounts of times between the ban announcements. And they also have been very emphatic at this point that, like, emergency BNRs, unless something is absolutely, like, untenably bad. And Nadu was not, in Modern, was not considered untenably bad. They're going to stick to this schedule. And that does, I have heard from Legacy players that it's going to suck now to have to wait. You know, the next BNR is not until after Eternal Weekend Pittsburgh. So Eternal Weekend Pittsburgh, unless something happens, which it won't, will probably just be Psychic Frog the format, unless, you know, people figure something else out, which they very well may. I have seen Nadu, like borderline Modern builds of Nadu putting up results in Legacy events post grief ban, which is, I guess we should have seen it coming, really.
Yeah.
but I don't know. I feel for Legacy. Legacy kind of seems like the format that did not end up in the best spot after the bans, but, and it won't be fixed anytime soon either. But
the problem you have with Wizards treating this cadence towards RCs, which RCs and RCQs, which makes total sense on their part. Where does Legacy fit in that? There's not an RC format for Legacy. So do you just do bans whenever? Do you just do it on the next BNR? Do you just get round to it when you feel like it? It feels a little lost because Legacy's not obviously a support competitive format.
Yes, like Wizards. Exactly.
So how does that align with everything else? Yeah. What I've heard about Psychic Frog, granted, I'm not a Legacy player. I've just heard that Psychic Frog offers similar play patterns to Dreadhorde Arcanist, which is already a banned card in Legacy. So like, I'm going to trust the Legacy experts saying this card should be around. I'm probably going to go with them, to be honest.
Yes, exactly. But it still does seem, though, that, like, even though Psychic Frog is maybe a power outlier, there's still, like, a good enough Eldrazi deck that Eldrazi can maybe keep it down. Painter's coming back. Reanimator is there. But we will see. I would not doubt if Psychic Frog does kind of just end up eating the ban, dealing combat damage and to draw cards, and having flying is very good.
Also, just true. Good pitch fodder.
Yep. Just pitching. You know, pitching cards for value in your Murktide Regent deck sounds good to me. It's a little bit of a non-bow. Well, no. Yeah, no, you do have to delve away the instant and sorcery cards to Murktide Regent to get your counters. However, if your Murktide Regent's already out and you also have a Psychic Frog and you give your Psychic Frog flying, you can put a +1/+1 counter on Murktide Regent then.
Synergy.
I'm cooking. Discard a bunch of instants and sorceries to pump up your Psychic Frog. Exile those to Murktide Regent to make a big Murktide Regent.
Profit.
I don't know. I'm out of ideas. Anyways, look forward to see how Legacy continues to evolve. And that's all the bans. The formats are settling in. And the thing is, as far as Magic the Gathering news goes, we're just kind of chilling right now. We're in Duskmourn preview season. We'll talk about Duskmourn here in a second. The other thing that did kind of go down, at least in my adjacent circles in the last 2 weeks, was there was someone attempted to make a CDH rules committee. There was a CDH rules committee attempt, which was not surprising to me that someone or, you know, a group of people decided to shoot their shot at it, because Jim LePage of the rules committee did come out in a Twitter thread and more or less say, hey, the EDH rules committee is not interested, nor do we really have the time to, like, consider and balance for the CEDH scene or a CDH tournament scene. So if the community wants this to happen, it'll have to come up from within the CDH community and you guys will have to figure that out, which, yep, makes sense. And in that vein, I am not surprised that someone tried. It did not go well. I don't really want to get into all the specifics of it, but it didn't go well. But I think the kicker is that this is something that could work. If people who like to play CEDH in a tournament setting do have needs that are not being met by the EDH committee, and then they want to effectively spin off into their own format and try that out, then I think, you know, it's worth doing. Like, many of the greatest formats that exist in Magic the Gathering are fan-made, and if we can have, like, another successful fan-made format, even if it's one that's birthed from another, that seems like a net positive to me. Anyways, I have a whole lot of words on this exact topic, actually, that you can read right now from my TCG Player article that will have been published by the time that this episode is out. So I'll link it in the description. I don't want to talk about it at length today, but I have thoughts about the entire concept as a whole. I'm sure Emma has none.
So looking on Twitter, so I've started to curate my feed in a way that tries to avoid discourse, and 99% of the time I usually miss it, but this time I didn't. It just came out of nowhere. And when there's like a mixture of Google Doc links and screenshots, you know it's not good.
Yeah, it's not going well.
That doesn't seem great. And I was like, I don't know where this started or if this is ending. I don't know if it's still going. It's just like, it just seems a bit of a mess.
Of 2 days ago at time of recording, it's no longer going. I do think that Evan, better known as Freedom Waffle in online circles, who was a part of the committee, did honestly do a admirable job of trying to address many of the concerns that were immediately raised. Working with people, chatting with people, gathering a bunch of information, making changes on the fly to what people were saying. But then before long, there was 5 people, and then there was 3 people, and then there's 2 people, and then there was just Evan. You know, people quit the team, and then it was just Evan, and Evan said, okay, well, I guess I'll just wrap it up. So I hope the community learned a lot. There's definitely lessons to be taken from this. That's all I gotta say. That's all I gotta say. All right. Well, I think that's all the news. Emma, is there any news that we missed? Oh, we have a breaking news, actually, in the middle of recording this podcast. Netflix's Magic the Gathering series is officially dead. Shocker. Years ago, we did hear that there was supposed to be an animated Magic the Gathering series that was coming down the pipeline. But per this article on Collider, Brandon Routh, who was supposed to voice, I believe, Gideon in the show, shared with Collider's Steve Weintraub during an interview that... it was announced all the way back in 2019, so it's been a minute. It's been the better part of 5 years since this was announced and was supposed to be released in 2022. Like, this isn't news, actually. We all kind of assumed this was dead. But Brandon Routh, who was supposed to be in it, did share that it was, like, it's officially gone. It was supposed to be directed and produced, by the Russo brothers, which is insane, actually.
That would have been sick. I mean, this is not surprising, but it's just kind of, I guess it's good to know that it's not happening.
Yep, exactly. It was like supposed to be like the first, that team left for creative differences, and then like a new executive producer came in, and like the people who were supposed to be working on it was pretty notable, but it just, I mean, I'm not surprised that we didn't get there. It's like Magic the Gathering is popular, but Magic the Gathering's IP has never been popular, which is, I guess, why we've kind of ended up in this situation where every IP except for Magic the Gathering's own is what is heavily featured in the marquee sets. So, you know,
It kind of aligns with what Wizards are trying to do in like a digital sense, like keep to like the digital gaming side of things rather than go into, you know, multimedia or like episodes and movies and stuff. So it's probably not surprising, but it would have been cool to see something.
You know, Emma, I agree, but it is not meant to be. Well, I suppose we should go ahead and move on to the recurring segment of the show where we talk about all of the wonderful products that you can buy from Wizards of the Coast that have been announced since the last episode. It's time for the Product Watch. The Product Watch is presented by Card Conduit, the easiest way to sell your Magic cards. After all, you need to clear out space for all the new products we're about to discuss. Brought to you by the beloved team behind Card Hoarder, Card Conduit does the hard work of getting you the best buy list prices available for your cards. All you have to do is send them one package, taking advantage of your selection of their three services. I use the sorted service, which has you collate and enter cards ahead of time in return for the lowest fees. Don't worry, you can just send them a huge box of random unsorted cards too, and they'll figure it out. I've used Card Conduit myself 5 different times to thin out my collection and have had exclusively great experiences. Use code HORN at checkout or use the link in the podcast description to get 10% off your fees and help support the show. All right, Emma, it is time for the Product Watch. And there's really just one thing even to talk about in the Product Watch today, I think, unless there's like a secret lair or something that I missed.
There is a Duskmourne secret lair coming.
Oh, well, it's time to talk about Duskmourne and maybe even its secret lair. Duskmourne, spooky set. I thought it was going to be like spooky. And then I thought it was going to be really, like, cheesy, tropey. And then I thought it was going to be real spooky. And now I've realized it's both going to be real spooky and real cheesy, tropey. They have managed to do...
They've ticked a lot of boxes with this set.
The worst of both worlds, Emma. That's what I'm going to say.
Okay.
No, I'm kidding.
I mean, I'm not a big horror person. So the themes for me are, like, lost. However, just... looking at the set for a magnifying glass, as I often do, people seem a lot more hyped about the set than I was initially like predicting. I expected Duskmourne to be, you know, let's talk about scale here, just slightly under Outlaws of Thunder Junction in terms of like excitement, themes, design. You know, we've hit the crest with Modern Horizons 3 and Bloomborough. There has to come a dip at some point. And I thought Duskmourne might be that dip. But it looks like Duskmourne is going to be pretty popular. While Bloomborough was really good for like casual players with all these adorable animals and really easy like themes and mechanics, Duskmourne seems to be a bit the opposite of that. It seems to cater towards like the competitive players, the more advanced players. So you got some mechanics that, you know, sure, they're going to be a little complicated for like really casual players and newer Magic players, but I'm seeing a lot of competitive players get really excited about it. I've seen Yeoman 5 already cooking up lists, just going, yeah, this set's great. I've got so much stuff here. And that's a really good sign.
Definitely. Yeah, it seems like this set both has like the mechanical complexity to keep people excited, like you were saying, and it does have a theme that, like, while it obviously does not appeal to you or me, as we've been vocal about so far in this show, it does really appeal to a lot of people. You know, horror is, like, the most popular movie genre pretty much that exists for a reason, right? And there's a lot of tropes. There's a lot of space to play in. This is a tough episode for Dan to miss, because I know they would come to bat for the horror tropes. I know horror is their stuff, you know?
It's also modern horror, which we haven't really seen in the Magic set before. So sure, we've had a slew of, you know, Innistrad sets over the last while. So it's really nice to see Wizards approach modern in the last, horror in the last, 4 years? Something more recent for people to engage.
Yep, definitely. I struggle. I get that people really like it, and I'm thinking about the latest State of Design article that Mark Rosewater writes every year in like his cons column for 2024. Well, looking back at 2023, or like the last year of set since he wrote it, really, whatever that time frame is, probably the fiscal year. One of like the lessons taken was like we were too on the nose with our tropes. I even pulled it up. He said resonance is good, but there's such a thing as too much of it. I feel this year we leaned a bit too far in that direction. With numerous sets, the volume of cards on a certain topic was simply too high, and our overtone was at times too meta in its creation. We do want to continue to make cards about topics that excite people, but we need to look at our execution. And I think that, like, we're still really tropey, and, like, we're still... all the tropes are really on the nose, but And it has felt that way for, like, Outlaws. It felt that way, I guess, in retrospect a little bit with Bloomburrow, but I liked Bloomburrow, so I overlooked it. And it kind of feels that way with Duskmourn, too, but the cards are just sick in Duskmourn, actually. Like, they independent, are, the cards, independent of...
The cards look great.
Yes.
I think my take on the tropey stuff, there's one or two ways you have to approach it. You either ignore it, or you go in unabashed, you know, being super deliberate about it. Like, you need to go like 100% in. I don't think you can just sprinkle it in here and there, because it's just going to look a little lost, which, you know, I've seen some comments about Duskmourn where there's some tropes in the set where it's just like, this just feels a little lost in the midst of what we're working with here. So it's fine to have that. You could make Duskmourn this really campy horror set and be like, really, really deliberate with it. And I think people would appreciate it, because it means wizards can, you know, be less serious about it, if that makes sense. And that creates some sort of endearment and charm. And it's like, cool, they were bold to do this thing. But when it's sprinkled in the sense of like Thunder Junction and Duskmourn, it can feel a little forced in a way that the audience doesn't appreciate.
Definitely. But it does seem to be working out for a lot of people. So we shall.
People seem stoked.
Yeah, exactly. So not for me, but for many. You know, I figured we could talk about the mechanics of the set, kind of run them down a little bit, because I think the mechanics are awesome. So first up on the list are rooms. Rooms are really slick. They are split permanents that have, you know, one effectively two halves of a card on a card arranged in a landscape orientation. And then when you choose to cast a room, you have to cast one of the halves, and then you get whatever enter the battlefield effect or passive effect that half of the room has. And then at any point, if you can pay the mana cost of the other half, you can do so at sorcery speed to unlock the door. And then you also get the other half, other halves cards, the other half of the cards, advantages, effects, what have you. Kind of cool. This feels a little finicky to me.
Yeah. It reminds me of Adventure with permanence and no weird exile zones, which is good. However, you have a real hard time tracking which room's been unlocked. And it would be really cool if Wizards could print a token that you just overlap on one of the sides. And it's like,
unlocked.
So it's like, cool, I'm playing this room. This side's covered, this side's unlocked. This is the only side that appears, but I don't know if that exists. We haven't seen the tokens for the set yet. But yeah, I can see it being a pain from like a sort of tracking and visual standpoint when trying to play the game.
Yeah, that's definitely an annoyance that I can see. I wish that there's just like a small disconnect for me with how a lot of the past split cards have worked. You can't cast both sides of the room together if you have all your mana. You have to cast one side, and then you have to unlock the other at sorcery speed, which can kind of be
also
a disadvantage.
The mana values always also align with what rooms you unlock. So if you unlock one side that's free mana, that card will be free mana. Unless you unlock the other side, then it gets the combined cost. Wizards did a pretty good mechanics guide, like FAQ on it, that really runs through, because it's like, okay, I would not expect that to work. Also, unlocking a room is a special action, so it's very similar to,
so we have,
you know,
a new special
a vehicle
action.
Yeah, it's a new special action, so you can unlock the other side and get the thing before someone tries to like remove
because special actions are like just an action you can take at any time if the stack is empty at sorcery speed and no one can respond to it.
Yeah.
Playing a
land. Just stops to feel bad.
Yep. Definitely. Definitely.
Which is good.
All right, Emma, what's our next mechanic on the list?
So this one I like from a flavorful standpoint, because I think we've all related to this at some point in our lives. So this is Manifest Dread, not to be confused with Disguise in Karlov Manor. So Manifest Dread is a new mechanic where if you were to Manifest Dread in Duskmourn, you look at the top two cards of your library, you manifest one of them, which means you place it onto the battlefield as a 2/2 creature, a colorless creature, and then you put the other one into your graveyard. If it's a creature, you can pay the mana cost of that creature and then flip it. However, if it's like a land or a non-creature spell, it just stays.
You're
as
just
a
2/2. Stuck with a 2/2.
You're just stuck with a 2/2. So it's very similar to Manifest that we saw in Fate Reforged, but it's also very similar to Disguise in Karlov Manor,
which that is gives very your creatures similar more two. To a morph from.
Yeah, there's a lot of 2/2 colorless permanents knocking around in standard, especially. But this seems really cool, and it also just seems really flavorful. Just a riff on Manifest Dread just sounds really good. You're chipping away at the top of your library. Often the library is a sign of like your intelligence when you're playing Magic. So that's being whittled away through going around the Duskmourne house.
You get to fill in your graveyard, which is usually very useful in these kind of scary sets. That usually means you're messing around with the graveyard. Yeah, it just all works out. This mechanic is
very flavorful.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. I love it. Up next we have Survive. It's a triggered ability. It's like a shortcut word. I forget exactly what they call these. It's not technically a mechanic, but it is something you will see on a lot of cards. A flavor word. I think that's what I'm looking for. So Survive, it is a triggered ability that you'll find on a lot of the humans in the set. Go figure. It's a triggered ability that looks for a tapped creature. So if a creature has Survive at the beginning of your second main phase, if it is tapped, it will do a thing. The very fun, mechanical and like thematic idea being like, oh, you went into combat and you lived, you went and faced the horrors and you made it out. There's a big like survivor theme amongst the humans in the set. It's pretty simple, pretty slick. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of like in limited, you're going to have to make a lot of tough decisions about what to attack and, you know, whether or not you want to attack. And then, you know, Defender often has the advantage in Magic the Gathering, especially in limited. So you get to put the ball in their court and then, now my creature lived. I got an effect. My creature died. I don't get an effect. But Caustic Bronco is a card that is legal in standard. So I'm just waiting for them to print an awesome Survive creature that I'll be able to, quote unquote, crew my Caustic Bronco with so I can play Dark Confidant in standard. That's what I'm here for.
Well, you've got plenty of applications. You've got stuff like, I believe, Relic of Legends and Dominaria United. That taps a creature. When you get into older formats, you have Springleaf Drow, which is, you know, sometimes seems modern play. So if there's a really cool survivor card in modern, you know, Springleaf Drow's a really good way to pay off that. Also, Convoke in standard is a thing, and Convoke makes you tap your creatures so you can get some survival triggers if needed. So there's some really cool, fun synergies there. I haven't seen anything too powerful with survival. There is an uncommon from the set that is going in my cube, though. It's basically Mardu Way Reaper, but gets bigger when you exile X cards, which is sick. So next up we have Eerie, which is a triggered ability that focuses on enchantments. So the thing is with Duskmourne, it is an enchantment focused set. So a lot of cards will have enchantment typing, such as enchantment creatures, for example. So Eerie is basically, it's an effect that you often see on creatures. Whenever an enchantment or a room enters the battlefield, you get an effect. That could be draw a card, that could be Manifest Dread, it could be something else. You could mill something. What's really cool about this is that if you were to play a room that is an enchantment, you get one trigger, but if you unlock that same room card, you get another effect. So two rooms get you two Eerie triggers, which is just something to keep in mind.
Yep, and that's honestly really awesome. This is another, it's a really cool, all of these mechanics, I think, kind of all add up to being really flavorful and also just like useful.
It's a very enchantment focused sort of mechanic, which is just something to bear in mind when, you know, we have stuff like Enchantress in Commander and you have Xur piles. So, you know, you got like Scrabbling Skull Crab, which is this one mana 0/2 crab that has a trigger where Eerie trigger that whenever you enchantment comes into play, target player mills to.
Yep. Sounds sick. Sounds good.
Sounds sick. Like you can mill yourself. That seems cool.
Exactly. our final mechanic here is Impending. This one's a little more complicated. So I have an example card here in a second. Impending is an alternate cost that makes whatever card you're casting, which I believe they're all creatures, enter the battlefield with time counters on it. And as long as that creature has time counters on it, that creature is not a creature. It just has whatever types it may have past being a creature. You remove a time counter at every end step. I'm sure there's like some uncommon or something that'll mess with time counters too, to like help pay off in limited or whatever. And then when all of the counters are removed, the card becomes a creature again. The example creature I have here is Overlord of the Hauntwoods. It would normally cost you three green, so five, and it is a 6/5. So it's pretty big for five mana. But and then whenever it enters or attacks, you create a tapped colorless land token named Everywhere, that is every basic land type. However, Overlord of the Hauntwoods also has Impending Four. Its Impending Four costs one green. So for three mana, it's also an enchantment creature. That's extremely relevant. If you pay three mana instead of five mana, you will get an enchantment that enters the battlefield. It does ramp you. It ramps you quite well, actually. It gives you a tapped land that makes every land color. It makes every color. So you can pay three mana, get a whole new land that will ramp you, obviously, because it's a new land, and it fixes your mana perfectly. And then after four end steps, you'll also get a 6/5 out of the deal. In this specific example, this is a mythic, but in this specific example, that four turns feels like a long time to wait to have your, you know, to invest three mana into getting a 6/5. But that's just an example of one of the like marquee, impending cards that they have showed off.
The cool thing about this, so there's been some comparison to Suspend just because of the use of like time counters. However, Impending actually puts the permanent in play beforehand. So you can, if you've got enchantment removal, you can just deal with it straight away. And then it just comes into play as a creature once that it just basically changes types after a while. So this card, Overlord of the Hauntwood, looks pretty exciting for Standard, especially when Foundations comes out and we have Llanowar Elves. That will be pretty fun.
Well, and we already have a Domain is like almost a Standard deck still. So, you know, I mean, this is the perfect Domain card.
Yeah.
So why not have another card that you can pay three mana and instantly have 5x Domain? Seems pretty good. Yeah.
So Impending only works on five creatures. It's a cycle. And I believe they all say Impending Four, I believe, based on the other four cards I've seen. They all have Impending Four.
All right. I was about to ask, do you know if these are actually only on the Mythic Overlord cycle? Okay.
Yeah, at the time of recording, the black one has not been previewed. We only know the other colors. I'm personally a big fan of the white one, Overlord of the Mistmoors, because it's basically Grave Titan in white, and that's just sick. And I love Grave Titan,
it
so
it costs cool four. To have that on a white card. Costs four for its Impending Four, and then when it enters or attacks, it's like better Grave Titan because it gives you two one flyers.
Yep. Seems sick.
Disgusting.
It's a cool mechanic. I think people are going to get a little lost and forget that you can actually interact with these permanents.
Yep.
Especially if people are coming from like Suspend.
Definitely.
And stuff like that.
Definitely.
Just one tip, just make sure you put this in the correct zone, as in where you would put your enchantments and not treat it as a creature, even though it's not a creature, because you could probably get in trouble for that.
Yep. You gotta look out for that. But I think these cards are sick. It's a sick mechanic. And that's all the mechanics that we have in Duskworn, I think. Why are there three set symbols in the packs that I can open, Emma? What's up with that?
I mean, that's pretty standard for Wizards now. So you have Duskworn, which is the base set. You have Duskworn Commander, which is the commander set, which has the white symbol in the middle. And then you got Special Guest, which is also standard for releases these days. I got a lot of like tweets from people going, Emma, can you just post the set codes for the set? And it's like, here's an article from Wizards. I just regurgitate that. And it's very simple to follow this time. This is Outlaws of Thunder Junction was a one-off.
I was about to say, was there five or six in that? I know that's when it kind of started.
It was five because the Big Score was meant to be a supplemental set as part of like, it was meant to have an Aftermath booster range, but they realized the Aftermath set did really bad, so they merged it all into one, but it made it really confusing from a set code standpoint, so they just made the best of a bad situation. But yeah, it's not going to be that bad again, touch wood.
I hope not. We're past, like, I think we're past all the aftermath sets and all that now. So what were planned to be aftermath sets, I hope. But all right. I said it at the top, but I also put it in the notes here at the end. This set's just not for me. It feels weird to say that. The theming of the set is just not for me. I have struggled to, like, pay attention. There's a lot of eye-centric stuff in this set, which is like a phobia of mine.
Eyes.
There's a lot of eyes. Having one eye for the majority of my life has led to me having like a lot of like weird eye-related phobias. So there's a lot of cards in the set where I'm just like, ah.
Hey, I had it with Phyrexia and teeth. So
fair.
A lot of teeth in Phyrexia.
Well, we have said, I think, all that there is to say about Duskmourn. We'll have to ask Dan their opinion on the next episode. I'm sure they'll be here on the next episode. It's only the second episode they've ever missed, so I'm sure they'll be on the next one, and we can say, Dan, what do you think about Duskmourn? And they'll either give us the most enthused or the most downer review possible, I'm sure. I don't think there could be any in between. If you're a big horror fan, it feels like this either has to be like a home run or a huge disappointment.
Yeah, which is just like a lot of horror movies from what I can gather. So,
you know, horror fans are used to it. All right. Speaking of our co-hosts' opinions, it's time to move on to the section of the show where our co-hosts' opinions matter the most. It's time for the co-host's notebook. Welcome to the co-host notebook, the part of the show where the co-hosts tell me what we're talking about for a few minutes. Emma, what have you written down in your very real, very physical co-host notebook with a curly Q pen?
So as you can see by the show notes, Cal, there's a lot of caps.
I was about to say, there is a lot of caps.
That's because the NFL season started this past weekend.
Woo!
Exactly. It's really exciting because football's great. Unless you're a Carolina Panthers fan, which I am. We had a really good start to the season. Good Lord.
Well, how did that Saints
and,
game
and
go?
Somehow Sam Darnold's doing great at the Vikings. Yep. What the hell?
Same as
what
it ever
timeline
was.
Are we in?
Same as it ever was.
Look, what is going on?
There
I'm
were
so confused.
So many quarterbacks love to leave where they started and go and be successful elsewhere.
That is the Carolina Panther effect. Happened to McCaffrey as well.
Yep, exactly.
football season started.
Yeah,
I'm excited because I love sports. I'm a big American sports fan. Going into the season, I knew the Panthers were going to be really, really bad. I just didn't know how bad. Fortunately, I saw it in the first 5 minutes against the Saints. So I'm set up for the season.
Did you?
And it's going to be painful.
Did you sit and watch the whole game?
No.
How much did you watch?
The first 5 minutes.
Yeesh. Fair enough. Final score, 47-10. Not good.
Yeah. Not good. It's going to be a long season.
How did you become a Carolina Panthers fan? Like, because they've been bad for, I mean, Cam Newton, they were good when Cam Newton was around, but
Cam Newton was good until we saw the life exorcism in the 2016 Super Bowl against the Denver Broncos. And then that's where Sam Darnold got his my theory is Sam Darnold always talks about ghosts, and I suspect it's Cam Newton's spirit just moseying around,
just haunting
from that Super Bowl.
Yep, definitely.
So I became a Carolina Panthers fan, what, best part of 10 years ago now. My sister-in-law is from Charlotte, North Carolina. Her family are massive Carolina sports fans in general. They tend to be bigger basketball fans than football fans, so they support the Hornets, who also suck. They are real bad. And just since then, I was just like, cool, football seems great. I guess I just picked this team. I didn't pick it on success or anything like that. And here I am, still disappointed 10 years later.
That's no fun. That's no good. My own Indianapolis Colts, I feel a little more... I'm a little more hopeful about.
At least that game was interesting.
We did lose, but we put up a good fight against like what many people would consider to be like a lock for the playoffs this year in the AFC against the Houston Texans. So our run defense was not great. That definitely lost us the game. But like a lot of the elements of the team that I personally had questions about looked really solid. So So I'm happy that football's back, but I'm sorry also, the Panthers are bad.
Also, like, the Texans are doing great because we didn't take CJ Stroud.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So it's our fault. That's our fault. Like,
yep.
You probably lost because it was passively our fault as well.
If only your owner didn't stink so bad and didn't bully his GM and coach into drafting a terrible quarterback instead of drafting...
The best thing you can ask for in sport when you want to run a club as a coach is to have a rich person that doesn't talk. They are very quiet and they just give you the checkbook.
They give you the checkbook David and then Tepper you make them a that. Ton of money.
Yeah, David Tepper does not do that. Having a loud, rich person is very dangerous to American sports, especially, you know, in NFL. And we're seeing, like, the fallout from that now. Tepper's taken a step back this season. I'm like, for what? He's trashed the team. However, it is 2 weeks until the hockey, and I'll be in much better spirits then.
Who do you cheer for hockey?
Carolina Hurricanes, who are actually quite
good. They're actually quite good, yeah.
Yeah, they always hit playoffs. We're cursed in the playoffs, but we always hit the playoffs.
Yep. Makes sense to me.
The Hurricanes have not won Eastern Conference final since 2006, when they last won the Stanley Cup.
So they just have to make it past that, and then they're golden.
Yeah, basically.
We can logically deduce thusly. You doing anything else beyond thinking about how bad the Carolina Panthers are? I assume you're playing Baldur's Gate 3.
Yeah, I just finished Act 2.
You're schmoovin'.
I replayed. Act 2 is really small, like misleadingly small, I found. So small, I actually redid it again because I missed a ton of stuff somehow, and it was still small. So yeah, just finished Act 2. That seems fun. I also downloaded Space Marine 2 today, which just came out, and I'm going to play some Space Marine because I'm a big Games Workshop fan as well. So I'm looking forward to playing that co-op with a few friends.
Nice. That sounds fun. Just bonking people.
Basically, yeah. I mean, the first one was great. It's just like, it's basically Gears of War in a space Marine suit. Basically, it's fun, hack and slashy. It's just well written, you know. It's a nice break from all the massive RPGs I played lately. Let's put it that way.
A change of pace. We love a change of pace.
Yeah.
So I'm playing Astrobot right now, and that's a 3D platformer.
Ooh,
and that's been
that's really good.
It's so good. It's like, even if you like aren't that much into Sony stuff, which like I'm not. I'm not a lifelong Sony gamer like a lot of people are. And it is like a very good like love letter to Sony and a lot of the different iconic games and franchises and stuff that have been on the PlayStation platform. But it's just an objectively incredible 3D platformer game, the likes of which I have not played in an extremely long time. And 3D platformers are like basically my favorite genre of game. So I'm feasting.
Sounds very nostalgic.
Yes, I would say that's correct.
Especially. Sounds
yes.
very nostalgic.
Definitely. Did you just hear the car honking outside of my house?
I thought it was outside my place.
Well, all right, I think that's all we have for this episode of the Herald's Horn. As usual, I thought there was two of us. We're gonna go short. No, not a chance. Not a chance. We're talking out here. Emma, do you have anything to leave our listeners with before we go?
Yeah, don't support the Carolina Panthers. You'll thank me later.
We have a great interview coming up. It's Elliot on the state of magic judging. I know it'll be a good one. Thanks for listening. See you on the other side. Hey there. Thanks for listening to this podcast episode. If you want to help support the podcast, check out our Patreon. You'll get a sticker in the mail and access to our Patreon exclusive content, which I'm always cooking up more of every day. We've got bonus questions with guests, exclusive interviews, me thought dumping about magic in my life. What else could you want? Plus, when we read letters to the editors, those sent through Patreon DMs or the Discord get first priority. Yep, we have a Discord that you'll be thrown into. Come talk to me about professional wrestling. Anyways, without any further ado, let's get back into this episode. Okay. tell here from the editor's booth, you may hear some of my wife's joyous D&D game going on during my half the interview. So if you hear that, ignore that. They're having fun. It's okay. People can have fun. All right, thanks. Thank you. And welcome back on this half of the show. Today, this episode, I am joined by the one and only Elliot Raff. Is your last name pronounced Raff? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so every time I look at your last name, Elliot Raff, I'm like, somehow this looks to me like a pitfall. This is, surely it's Raffe for no reason whatsoever, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, I've run across people who have asked me that before. I'm like, no, it just is the simple one.
It just is Raff. Okay. Excellent. That's what I thought. Just double checking. Well, thank you for joining me today, Elliot, on this episode of the Herald's Horn.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me.
Of course. And we today are going to be talking about a topic that I think is very relevant to the current Magic the Gathering scene, especially the greater competitive play scene, and that is the current state of Magic the Gathering judges. Recently, you wrote an article for Commander's Herald entitled Organized Play Cannot Exist Without Judges, where you laid out the plight of the judging program worldwide, and especially in the United States. But also worldwide, obviously, and kind of laid out your perspective of what is wrong and what needs to change. But before we hop into all of that, Elliot, can you introduce yourself a little bit to the listeners?
Sure. My name is Elliot Raff, as you've said. I've been a judge for about 12 years now. Back when I had a level, which I no longer do because I do not subscribe to any current certification, I achieved a level 3 under the old Judge Academy and level 4 under Judge Foundry. I've worked many large events, Grand Prix, Pro Tours, the whole gamut, and have been playing Magic for a very long time. I've been involved with many different communities, including Commander and Cube, and was even lucky enough to qualify for the Pro Tour as a player last year.
I was about to say, you do share, if you weren't going to say it yourself, I was going to say you are one of, I assume, a very select people, a group who have both played and judged the Pro Tour, especially in recent history.
Yeah. I think that club is not very large, and I'm certainly fortunate to be a part of it. Really getting to both work and play in the Pro Tour was a culmination of two different kind of careers in Magic, and certainly one that I don't take for granted on either side of it.
Definitely. So, Elliot, thank you for joining me again. I have my first question locked up and ready to go. It's a softball. I hope you're ready. But I think it is an important one, actually. So what is Magic judging? Like, what does a Magic judge do? Especially, you know, I am very aware that a relatively large amount of my listener share are people who have not actually, you know, have probably not participated in an event like at competitive REL, or maybe even like at an FNM that was large enough to happen to have a L1 on staff or whatnot. What is a Magic judge, and what does a Magic judge do?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and honestly has a lot of different answers. I don't know about that.
that's the joke, Elliot.
So as you alluded to, Magic judging encompasses a wide range of areas. At its core, judging is, or a judge is, someone who basically provides customer service and structure during an event. They solve rules disputes, policy disputes. If something goes wrong during a game, they're generally the one to fix it. But that can vary greatly depending on whether or not you're at an FNM or, you know, a 5K or a Pro Tour. So it, at its broad 10,000 foot view, judges are really customer service professionals who basically make it possible for Magic events to be fair and fun.
Yes, because of course, without judges or some kind of similar structure, there would not be a solution for so-and-so was cheating and I said they were cheating and they said they weren't cheating. And even, yes, even just like, oh, I accidentally shuffled my hand into my deck. Now what?
Yeah, exactly. You know, we deal with everything from I drew my opening hand in game one and I've had the sideboard card to, you know, I think my opponent's doing something shady.
And sometimes even cleaning up the pack trash during a draft.
Oh, absolutely. The J in judge actually stands for janitor. I don't know.
is there an entire anagram?
You know, I'm sure that there is, but
someone's done it.
I don't really remember the rest of it.
Fair. Okay, so talking about 10,000 foot views, Elliot, as of late, like I alluded to earlier, you have recently written an article entitled "Organized Play Can't Exist Without Judges." Given what you just said, that's pretty obvious, right? We need judges to help us fix rule disputes, to investigate cheating, to help us remember to clean up after ourselves, and all that kind of stuff that helps make sure that a Magic the Gathering event runs correctly and runs well. However, the tenor of your article, you know, obvious, the headline's obvious. Organized play can't exist without judges. Yes, but there's something implied in the title that I think a lot of people might not get on first pass. Or if they don't know what's going on right now in the larger organized play and judging scene, they may be confused by it. Of course, organized play can't exist without judges, Elliot. But are judges in danger of going extinct? Where are the judges going?
Well, I mean, that's a very dramatic way of putting it. But
no, yeah.
You're kind of not far off, which is the sad part and why I did write that article. So this is all encapsulated in my article for those who would like to read it. But the baseline is that for a period of going on about 9 or 10 years now, Magic judging has been on the decline. And the reason for that is because, again, about 9 or 10 years ago at this point, a group of judges under the former judge program, which was entirely run and supported by Wizards of the Coast, decided to sue them in a class action lawsuit, alleging that what their duties were tantamount to employees. And the resulting fallout from that has been that Wizards has very gradually decreased and has now stopped all support to whatever judge programs exist throughout the world.
And why specifically is Wizards of the Coast support important for judges to have? Like, what does Wizards bring to the table that judges need? This, again, may be a bit of an obvious question, but I kind of just want to set the table here.
No, it's certainly a good question. So really, judges need a couple of things from Wizards. One is opportunity, right? So I know that, you know, we're still coming out of COVID, or organized play is not what it used to be. The opportunities for judges aren't what they used to be. And I know that Wizards can't necessarily create more events overnight. But judging used to be supported through a series of events and conferences. So what this would do is that judges would come together. They would discuss everything ranging from customer service practices to rules and policy, depending on what you want to get better at. You would hear from your peers. You would network. And as a thank you for being a part of the judge program, Wizards would support these conferences by providing judge promos. You know, if you've been playing for any amount of time, you're probably aware that judge promos exist. They're special versions of cards that were given to judges basically just for being judges and for engaging in the community. But that has since gone away. And since that has gone away and there's no official structure and no monetary support coming from Wizards, there's very little incentive for judges to continue doing the hard work that they do, especially when there's fewer opportunity, there's less opportunity to practice your skills, to network with other judges, and to get better.
And let's set this straight, right? Like, they have removed what financial incentive that they were giving to the pot, which was like pretty much judge promos, giving some larger structure around these events and that kind of stuff. But the judge promos were, especially for a minute there, about all that judge were getting, right? Like, even if you like got all your judge promos and immediately resold them for their market value or whatnot, judging, at least for a while now, has kind of been like a monetary losing position, right?
Yeah.
Definitely, I mean, a little more of a labor of love, much like grinding Magic the Gathering is.
Yeah, absolutely. So judging's never been about the money. No one's ever really been able to make a good living solely on judging.
Think of the airline miles you get, though. Come on.
Oh, believe me, I've got quite a few back when I was, you know, doing this every weekend. But it is a labor of love. Judges do it because they love it. And, you know, the monetary compensation just makes it possible for us to do, because if we're traveling across the country to work all weekend and lose money, that's not necessarily a prospect that anyone wants to do. So it's a component. It's a component. It's not the be all and end all for sure. But there needs to be some support coming from Wizards, you know, if they're expecting their tournaments to continue to run at a high level.
I think like the complete removal of judge promos just feels like, at least for me on the outside, that was the thing that made me go, oh wait, there are things going wrong here. Because, like, you know, judges have been sounding the bells for a while, at least that I could see, because I'm a relatively invested member of the Magic the Gathering community. I knew it had been going downhill for a while. I knew there had been some different structural changes, which we can talk about in a while. But, like, it was just, like, back-to-back, like, there was some judge promos that were, like, some basic lands that didn't even look great, and then there were no more judge promos. And I was just like, oh, something's a little different here. Something's not right here. But that's just stinky, to use a technical term.
Yeah. I mean, the result of all of this is that, you know, experienced folks who were working, you know, many, many events each year have stopped for whatever reasons, that, you know, maybe it's the pandemic, maybe it's lack of support. But the fact of the matter is that it's becoming more and more difficult to get people invested in judging, especially when there are fewer events, especially when those events are frequently, I don't want to say not as well-staffed, because that entirely depends on what event you're going to, but the wealth of knowledge is not as broad. And because the wealth of knowledge is not as broad, you hear these, frankly, horror stories, you know, on social media or wherever you happen to get these stories about judges not being, on the whole, as competent as they used to be. And the sad truth is that there is a lot of truth to that. And, you know, without those learning opportunities, without those conferences, without incentive to keep perfecting your craft, there's just not, the impetus isn't there to get better.
Yes, definitely. It always has been like a very self-driven endeavor to begin with, because, you know, you're not making money. You have to learn a lot of fairly minute detail things. You have to memorize and learn and internalize how to properly apply a lot of policy. And then it all culminates in, like, the judges use the term customer service, and I think it's very well deserved. Then the end goal is you get to fly somewhere for a weekend and work a customer service job for 7 to 12 hours a day. So it's like not exactly the most glamorous lifestyle outside of the things that you get out of it. And Speaking still of Wizards' support of the program, how it kind of used to be, there's two major things that you said that are impacting where we are right now. And one of those things is the lack of Wizards' support. The easy thing to point to and the most visible thing to point to is like the promos and the conferences, right? The conferences where you could learn about a lot of stuff. The promos, which at minimum, we're like, hey, cool. Wizards of the Coast appreciates what I'm doing to help their game grow and thrive. And then, you know, depending on when you were judging, you could get a foil Wheel of Fortune that if you had still held on to until today and decided to sell it today, well, you'd be a pretty happy person. Amongst other fairly lucrative judge promos. But I think, too, there was a lot of less visible stuff that kind of evaporated in that change away from full-throated organizational Wizards support. You mentioned in your article that like the global judge program did go beyond like just running conferences and stuff too. There were people at Wizards whose whole not their whole job, but a big portion of their job was interacting with judges, and they subcontracted judges around the world to make sure that the local judging scene was working correctly. And then under them were more judges and under them were more judges. And there was like an entire tiered system of mentorship and making sure things were run correctly and helping stores find judges that they needed and linking people up with other people and all that kind of stuff. And that all kind of just evaporated overnight, right?
Yeah, pretty much. So the system in the past, when Wizards was completely operating the judge program, was that there was a judge community position at Wizards. There was a judge manager position. It's been held by, you know, wonderful people over the years, some of which are still in the building at Wizards in other positions now. And they subcontracted judges. There were those program coordinators that existed, which are a worldwide group of folks that were contracted and paid by Wizards to basically conduct the day-to-day operations of the judge program. More locally, even, there were the regional coordinators. So, for instance, when I was coming up, I was living in Boston, functionally in the Northeast region, and there was a regional coordinator that I could reach out to that was responsible for the Northeast region that would basically be your go-to person for anything that you needed done, for any complaints that you had, for disseminating feedback. And there was a structure and there was someone to go to if you were heard, or even if these people were all listed on the Wizards website. So if someone was looking to become a judge, they could look it up on the Wizards website. They would be directed to the regional coordinator. The regional coordinator would link you up with someone in your area who could help. There was an entire infrastructure to make sure that this program was alive and thriving. And now that's largely just gone away. There are organizations now, which I mentioned in my article, the kind of grassroots nonprofits that have risen up. The United States and Canada is called Judge Foundry. They're trying to emulate some of that same experience, but again, it's a monumental task that they're undertaking without much help or support.
Yes, definitely. Where did the organizational structure, what came in to replace it once Wizards let it lie? What came next?
Yeah, so next was a company called Judge Academy. So that was... I believe it had to be structured as a for-profit company because it was a global judge program that was owned by Tim Shields, who is the owner of Cascade Games. For those who have been around a while, they're an excellent tournament organizer out of the Seattle and Portland area in the Pacific Northwest. Judge Academy kind of took up this mantle. They had to functionally start from scratch and create a bunch of training mechanisms for judges, online certification, and distribution of conferences and promos. Sorry for the background noise there.
My just cat. Some caps rumbling.
So that was what came next. And there were a host of problems with that system as well. But by and large, what they did was kind of save the program for a little bit. And it was exceptionally bad luck that, you know, about a year into their existence, the pandemic hit, the world shut down. There was at least some support because Wizards was still supporting Judge Academy with these foils. I don't know the exact details.
I was always under the assumption that there was in knowledge that there was like some relationship there, but it was never very like strongly defined to anyone.
Yeah, I mean, there was a contract, mm-hmm. Certainly between Wizards and Judge Academy. And when that contract expired, I believe this would have been earlier this year, perhaps late last year now. Mm-hmm. This is about a year ago. So this is mm-hmm. last October. When that contract expired, Judge Academy functionally ended their support for Magic mm-hmm. Judges. And that's when Foundry came to be. And that's what we have now.
And then
in terms of the US and Canada.
Yes. And is there like marked differences in between like Academy and Foundry? I mean, like, it's obviously they have different names, but different leadership, different philosophy, different, you know, and obviously not directly associated with Wizards anymore, which Judge Academy was.
Right. Yeah. There are very distinctive differences. One is that Judge Foundry is a nonprofit organization. So that means that the laws governing the organization are very different. That means that they have to publicly disclose where their money is coming from and where it's going, for instance, which is a big deal. So they have to be far more transparent than Academy. Which, you know, is a boon. So for instance, their board of directors, they're not employees. They are elected by the members of the organization, just like any other nonprofit. Apart from that, the technology structure that they're using is different. The certification systems that they're using is different. The levels to maintain your certification is different. But everything else is more or less the same, right down to the fact that both Academy and Foundry required dues to be paid from judges. So basically judges had to pay some amount of money. It varied from year to year with Academy. Right now it's $5 a month for Foundry in order to have this certification and to gain access to testing materials.
Which is like... I get it, right? It's there's costs associated with running the organization, upkeep, so on and so forth. But that's kind of just another like diplomatic way of saying this. Downer.
Extremely diplomatic.
Yeah, it's better than saying like kicking the nuts. I don't.
Yeah, I mean. Look, to be frank, you know, the reason why I wrote the article in the first place is because I find it abhorrent that Wizards is not supporting the people that literally make their events possible.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we've kind of buried the lead on this entire thing. I mean, like, my bad. I've just been asking you all these little clarifying questions, but that's actually the story here. It does suck that judges are required for Magic the Gathering events to run and run well. In fact, you should want excellent judges at all of your Magic events if you are Wizards of the Coast, and yet they have done nothing at all. And in fact, they have done actively harmful things to that existing for the previous 3 years or more.
It's certainly been longer than 3 years.
Well, it got definitely markedly worse around the, like, you can point to, like, the start of Judge Academy, I know, was, like, a big sea change. The change to Judge Foundry was a big sea change. But before that, there was then, like, years and years of, like, weakening support, too.
Yes. I mean, look, I will say, you know, I'm not a lawyer. I know that this was all precipitated by these
lawsuits. Yes, the lawsuit.
And I'm not saying that Wizards, you know, needs to open themselves up to all kinds of future lawsuits from similar minded people to those that started this whole process. But the fact of the matter remains that other games, Flesh and Blood, Pokemon, Star Wars, all directly support their judge programs.
Yeah, they're doing it with no problems. It's not like someone else has said, hey, I bet we could do this exact same thing and then we're successful with it.
Right. And, you know, I'm not privy to all of the details, certainly, and I want to be very clear about that. But, I mean, the fact of the matter remains that the Magic has a bigger organized play system than all of these games maybe even put together. And the fact that they are trying to run these huge tournaments, you know, the Pro Tour coming back, the World Championships, the RCQs, means that there needs to be support. You know, when the RCQ and RC system was implemented, a lot of people thought that it was very similar to the old PPTQ RPTQ system. For those who weren't playing competitively back then, a PPTQ and the RCQ are functionally kind of the same thing. They were store level events that the winners got to go to another qualifying event. The RPTQ was kind of stand for regional PTQ, and so there wasn't a regional championship where the entire United States would gather, but maybe it was like the Eastern Seaboard has an RPTQ, or even the Northeast, that kind of thing. And I bring this up because under the PPTQ system, in order to run a PPTQ, you had to have a level 2 judge run it. This was a Wizards mandate. This was something that the regional coordinators had a great hand in coordinating. This was something that they enlisted other local judges around to make sure that all the stores were covered and that events were running well. Now, Wizards has no definition of what a judge is. so they cannot mandate these things. But to be frank, that's something that Star City Games could very well implement, saying you have to have someone
who knows. Because they're in charge now, yeah.
Yeah, or DreamHack could have done this under a previous regime. The tools need to exist to give judges opportunities to work and get better and to provide the excellent customer service that players deserve. And because we don't have opportunity, because there's no incentive, you know, you see judges not being as prepared. You see judges not having the wealth of experience that they need in order to serve players well. So, sorry, I went on a bit of a rant there.
No, that's a very good rant. I think that's like the if there were like two pillars in like what if the judge problem, if the problem with the judging right now is standing, there are two pillars underneath of it, one of which is Wizards specifically cutting off all of its support to the judging program, and the other one is together in conjunction with that, the listener cannot see me illustrating with my fingers. the other one is the massive like deflationary amount of events we have that need or specifically require judges. From my perspective, you know, I hadn't thought about the whole PPTQ system. I knew, you know, cause I was living my dreams, grinding out those PPTQs back when it was the PPTQ system. That's not me anymore, but man, when I was in high school, that was me. I never knew that they needed specifically a level 2. So that's a lot of experience right there. If your community needs level 2 judges to run the events it needs to run, well then you have to get these L1 judges. The L1 judges have incentive to go and judge events and learn and all this kind of stuff so that they can level up to level 2. But in your article too, though, even beyond just like the local judge level, you shout out that in 2019 there were 48 Grand Prix weekends across the world every weekend. That's nearly a Grand Prix every weekend. For those who are aware of the exact number of weeks in the year, I won't claim to be one of them, but I know 48 is close. that's nearly a massive tournament somewhere in the world every year. And like you said, they had around 100 personnel and a lot of judges worked at multiple of those Grand Prix every year. But even if me, local level 1 judge, you know, if I normally work at my local store. Sure, I can cut my teeth on the F&M calls. I can learn that stuff. It's a great place for me to maybe practice some of my customer service. You know, get ready to go with the easier stuff or what have you. But then, you know, I live in Columbus, Grand Prix Columbus or Grand Prix Detroit or Grand Prix Cincinnati or whatever rolls through town. Cool. I'll go work that. I can drive over there. I can make three booster boxes for my time. And that would be a great environment for me to work on the floor and interact with way more players from a much wider variety of backgrounds than I ever had before, working under much more skilled judges than I may have had it directly in my local scene. Or, you know, just I'm sure, you know, if I was an L1 working with an L2 or, you know, and even an L3 or whatever in my area, you know, in those days, I could meet another L2 or another three work under them or with them for the weekend, and they could share or teach me things that I had, you know, never thought of before that this L2 that I was working with locally may not care about. And like, and then I could go and do it again when SCG Indy rolled through town, right? There was 48 Grand Prix weekends. There were not that many less than that SCG weekends either. And that was other huge roving tournaments moving around. And then all the way down to the, you know, PPTQ system, the F&Ms. There's not that many F&M events out there anymore that keep L1s around. But when I was coming up, that was kind of just the norm. There would be an L1 at my F&M. Granted, I went to a store that got like 40 people for F&M, but I now go to a store that gets 40 people for F&M, and there's not an L1 there. Brian's there. He's an L1, but he's playing. He'll answer your call for you. but he's not, you know, being paid by the store to be there and be an L1. And so all of this, I think, adds up to what you were talking about at the very beginning of, like, even if we have, even if the judging community has best efforts, best intentions in mind, even if they do have a lot of the book knowledge, there is just so much that can only come from being in the trenches, learning from other people, learning from experience and all that kind of stuff. And a lot of those chances have evaporated because now we have four Magic Cons a year. We're getting the Spotlight series. Like you said, the RCQ system does not require judges to be very involved at a local level at all. Ideally they would be, but they're not required to be. And then we have a couple RCs as well now a year that require the staff too. But the opportunities to gain judging experience is a lot lower. Elliot, how instrumental was that in-person learning for you compared to, like, even, you know, if you were super actively judging right now? I assume that the opportunities to get out there and even, like, now you are a very well-regarded judge, but you don't have that many opportunities anymore to even, like, keep yourself sharp. I've got to imagine that's not great.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, for sure.
Yes.
When I started judging, I was actually pre-PPTQ system. I was in the PTQ system. And so that was when there were, you know, 150 to 300 person events happening maybe two or three times a month that were all in driving distance. And that was how I learned. You know, it was, they would hire a staff. You would have, you know, for about 150 to 300 people, you'd have a staff of maybe 8 to 12 judges, some of whom would be newer people who you would learn from, who would learn from the rest of the staff. And we had people working to make sure that people had opportunities. So, like, for instance, when I was coming up, I was lucky. I was living in a major city. I befriended our local level two judge, who was the person who certified me and started working with me and got me onto the staffs of these PTQs and 5Ks. And I was exposed not just to his point of view, which was fantastic. You know, he was a fantastic mentor, but I would learn from, you know, from people that he knew and that he respected, and got to cut my teeth. And more importantly, I had people tell me what I was doing wrong. You know, and that's the only way that a lot of people learn and get better. And because I had that connection, and I knew that, you know, this judge, who's, I'll just name off him, you know, his name's Casey Brefka. He's longtime L3, and, you know, until he retired a few years ago. He would vouch for me when it came time for larger tournaments to be staffing their Grand Prix and to be staffing their SCGs. And so that's how, you know, I got those opportunities to get better. I would say, you know, I really haven't worked that many large events since the pandemic, just, you know, mix of opportunity and you know, life.
And you were on your grinder arc there for a little bit too. Yeah, you still are, but you know.
Sure. But you know, even then, so if we're just talking just, you know, say 2012 to 2019, you know, I worked maybe, you know, in the area of 50 to 60 Grand Prix, probably around the same number of SCG Opens. And that's, you know, that's an extreme number for a lot of people. I'm not saying you need to work that much, but the point is I could. I could.
Yeah, you wanted to and the opportunity was available to you to do so.
Right. And because I loved what I was doing and because I had people who were willing to invest in me and I in turn invested in other people, we had a community that was determined to make each other better. And I'm not saying that community doesn't exist anymore. It, of course, still exists. But the opportunities are far less. And now it's not, hey, I've worked the whole weekend with this senior judge who's taught me a lot. I'll see you again next month. It's maybe I'll see you in 3 months if I get staffed. You know, it's just so much harder for new people coming up to learn and to learn effectively.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. That stinks. It's just like, it's a on-the-job training is like so much more effective than pretty much anything else you could ever have, especially in these extremely complicated situations that judges often have to handle that can very easily result in the, what you said earlier, quite frankly, horror stories we have seen come out of the events. And it would just be like, it's just better for everyone if these things don't happen. Judges don't want them to happen. It's like Elliot walking into an event like, this is my hall.
Well, and to me, to the Judge Foundry, to their credit, I do want to speak very briefly about that. To Judge Foundry's credit, they are trying to bring back the local community in a big way, and they're placing a very big emphasis on in-person learning and training, you know, to what degree it's been successful, I don't really know. But it's a big step forward from what we did have under Academy, because Academy was tasked with worldwide certification. So it was not very local. There was not a system. And actually, people could get certified and even get promoted in some cases entirely online. And so you had some folks who were very book smart or had just studied rules and policy going to these larger events, not having worked any events before, which was itself a problem. But credit to Foundry where that's due is that that is something that they are working very hard to eliminate and bring back into an in-person.
Yeah, which is like honestly super sick, but they can't also that like they can put that emphasis on it. But then also some of it does rely upon there just being enough events with demand for judges to get them in a central place to make that easier.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which come on, Wizards. Give us Grand Prix back. Spotlight Series doesn't count.
Well, look,
I know Grand Prix will never come back. I know why they're not around.
Something's always better than nothing, right?
Correct. Yeah. The addition of Spotlight Series is objectively awesome.
Yeah. And I'm excited for them. You know, I'm just, again, a little concerned because, like I said, the depth of the pool of knowledge is lower than it was. Mm-hmm. Right. So you are going to have extremely qualified judges at these Spotlight Series events. They will be there. There's no question about that. You know, whether or not they will be able to do all of them is another story. Whether or not the average floor judge will be as experienced and able to handle your call without you needing a second opinion is a big deal.
Yes.
So it comes down to opportunity and training and support. And obviously Wizards can't do anything, can't do much about the opportunity. But there can't be nothing.
Yep, definitely. So, Elliot, we're running out of time here, but I do want to ask you a question about you. You mentioned earlier that you currently are not certified, which I assume means that you are not a membership of Judge Foundry. Is there a specific reason why you have let your certification lapse? Is it just because, like, you're just not in the spot right now where you can judge a lot of events? Is it what's going on there?
Yeah, that's should have known this question was no, that's completely fair. So one is that as I mentioned before, I was living in the Boston area for a number of years, and really pre-pandemic. A lot of my time, energy, and for a decent amount of time, judging was my full-time job. As I've already alluded to, the money's not great. And I was using that mainly as a stopgap in between employment. So I've since moved. I live in Roanoke, Virginia now. It's a little more difficult to get out to events. My life has just changed in a number of ways where it's less practical for me to spend a long weekend spending PTO off work to go and work these events and have to come right back and work the next week. So that's part of the reason you might not have seen me judging as many events. That also coincided with qualifying for the Pro Tour last year. So I just started playing a lot more. It was just what I was enjoying doing. Why I'm not specifically a paid member of Foundry. I don't want to get too specific with.
Yeah, no, certainly.
Again, as I say in the article, I think the people who are at Foundry and who are working to keep judging alive in general are doing as much as they can. And I think they're doing this out of the goodness of their hearts, and they are heroic. So that's why I decided to stop for the time being. There's other reasons too that I won't necessarily.
Definitely.
I'm absolutely still open to rejoining in the future. I'm not saying that I will never rejoin. It's just that active event-based judging is not something that is a large part of my life anymore. And because of that, even I wouldn't be able to hit the maintenance requirements for the level that I'm
Yeah, full. Definitely. Yep.
So, I don't have six long weekends a year to go to work events.
Yeah, anymore. Definitely. Especially when those large events now have to be within fairly restricted time windows, as opposed to in the past where you maybe would have had a lot of choice.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Elliot, what can players do to help? The average person who's involved in the Magic the Gathering community, I know that Magic the Gathering players want good events, and we know that good events require judges, but is there, in your opinion, something that the average player can do to help out, judges in their plight?
I genuinely wish I had a better answer than I do.
Yeah.
My answer is, if you would like to express your displeasure with judges or any judging related matters, please take them up with Wizards of the Coast rather than necessarily yell at the particular person. Please recognize that judges are people and that we have been hit hard. This is not something that has an easy answer. I really wish that it did. But I think in general, my advice would be, please try to talk to judges as like you would your fellow players, and to be compassionate and ask questions rather than accuse. But as far as the average player wanting to help, please, if you know your tournament organizers, if you know your local stores, please ask them to staff judges for your RCQs, for your FNMs, for your large pre-releases. Insist that people who are on staff know the rules, know how to get answers, and just ask for better events. That's really what it comes down to. You can start that at your store level. You can go all the way up to Wizards. I'm rambling off the curve here. But really, what I'm asking for is that judges have been fighting this battle for years, and I genuinely don't think that people knew that, which is why I wrote what I did. Please join us. Please fight with us. It's really easy to look at judges as, you know, the people who are issuing you a penalty. That's not what we want to be doing. We want the events to be great just as much as you do. So just please recognize that we are members of this community too, and please work with us to make the events great.
Elliot Raff, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of the Herald's Horn. Is there anything else you would like to leave our listeners with?
If you'd like to talk to me about any of this, you can always contact me on Twitter at Raff, R-A-F-F underscore Sputin, S-P-U-T-I-N. If you're going to be at Regional Championship DC, please come up and say hi. If you're going to be at KubeCon, I'll be there judging as well. So, thanks everyone for your support, and see you at the next one.
I will put your Twitter and also a link to your article if people are interested in reading that, which you should. It's a very good article. That'll all be in the podcast description, the YouTube description. You can find that there. Elliot, again, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of The Herald's Horn. Herald's Horn is hosted, edited, and produced by me, Cal Jones. The co-hosts are Emma Partlow, Lexi, better known as Black Girl Mage, and Dan, better known as Moderately Anonymous MTG. All of our info lives in the podcast description. If you want to reach out to me, whether with feedback, you want to give me money, or you just want to send a letter to the editor, hit up editorial@heraldshorn.com. Thanks again for listening to The Herald's Horn. We are having so much fun creating it. See you in 2 weeks.